the goal was to cut the energy cost in half to 80% of the population. You know, we've always been concerned that it wouldn't accomplish those goals.
Fairbanks residents comment on the natural gas trucking project. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 19th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, small medical practices in Alaska struggle under the weight of federal requirements.
Unless you work for a large organization like a hospital, there's no economy of scale. I can't share these expenses with anybody.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build, from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
The state is a step closer to proving its North Slope to Fairbanks natural gas trucking project can work. The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority lead interior energy project is aimed at providing gas at about half the cost of heating oil. And as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, officials say they're honing in on the target.
The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority is crunching numbers. ADA officials are charged with making sure the plan to process North Slope natural gas and truck it to Fairbanks pencils out as an affordable energy option for people who currently rely on oil and wood heat. ADA Deputy Director Mark Davis says a recently completed financial model is providing a better picture of costs and resulting gas prices.
It's been under construction, the model, for months, but now it's in a point where we can use it, and that means we can plug numbers in and forecast costs. So for example, if we think the plant would cost so many million, we can look at that cost and the price of gas delivered.
Davis says the model shows the cost of infrastructure, like the centerpiece $200 million North Slope gas processing plant, will have relatively less impact on endpoint pricing than will operational costs.
The model shows something interesting. If you charge a fee of $1 million. That is the equivalent of putting $10 million into the LNG plant for construction. It's a 10-to-1 ratio, which shows you that you want to build a plant then that can be operated at low fees, because and it also shows you can afford to spend more on the plant than you can on maintenance. And so that means we need a low-maintenance plant.
Davis and fellow ADA representatives gave an overview of the financial model during a public presentation in Fairbanks. Davis expressed optimism the state will be able to deliver on the project. Welcome news to Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation President and CEO Jim Dodson.
You know, one of the things that we've always been concerned about is the scope of the project. And you, really, the governor designed the scope, and that was $15 million BTU energy. You know, so today, for example, we pay $30 million BTU for a gallon of diesel fuel. The goal was to cut the energy cost in half to 80% of the population as quickly as possible. For $355 million, you know, we've always been concerned that it wouldn't accomplish those goals.
The Interior Energy Project is supported by a $355 million legislatively approved package of grant, loan, and bond financing, but additional ADA and private money is needed. The state has partnered with the firm MWH on the North Slope Gas Project, and ADA Energy Infrastructure Development Officer Nick Shimoniak says the company is working with Northleaf, a pension fund, to help finance up to $100 million of the gas processing plant.
The additional Northleaf capital, the $50 to $100 million, is sufficient to fully fund the North Slope plant. The other aspects of the value chain, trucking, storage, and the distribution at the two utilities, FNG and the IGU, would also require additional outside capital.
Shimoniak says the state is working with the borough-owned Interior Gas Utility and private company Fairbanks Natural Gas to help finance distribution piping in the Fairbanks area. FNG President Dan Britton lists numerous projects happening in his company's service area in the core area of Fairbanks, piping that has the potential to add a lot of customers.
Around 2,000 from the work we're doing this year. We'll ultimately, we're looking to put in about 30 miles. This year we'll probably get close to 20 to 25 completed, and then we'll finish up the remainder and hopefully be doing more next year.
While FNG is focused on the core area of town, the IGU has begun preliminary work on its plan to pipe surrounding areas, including North Pole. The Interior Energy Project is targeting delivery of first gas to Fairbanks by late 2015 or early 2016. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
EHR, ICD-10, and PQRS may sound like alphabet soup to you, but most doctors around the country know exactly what those acronyms stand for. They are programs championed by the federal government to improve quality and to bring medicine into the electronic age. But in Alaska, where small medical practices are the norm, the new requirements can be a heavy burden. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Dr. Oliver Korshan doesn't want to use electronic records in his office. Starting next year, the federal government will penalize him for that choice, withholding 1% of his Medicare payments. So in February, the 71-year-old ophthalmologist mailed in a form requesting an exemption. He had to indicate which exemption category fit his situation.
The only one that possibly applied to me was disaster. So I picked disaster, and I described my disaster as old age, and I submitted as my supporting document a copy of my passport.
Korshan practices 3 days a week in the same small office in East Anchorage he's had for three decades. Many of his patients have aged into their Medicare years right along with him, like the 86-year-old woman visiting on a recent afternoon for a regular checkup.
Okay, come on forward and put your chin on the chin rest, and your head has to be right against the band.
Korshan has just one employee, a part-time nurse, and his lease runs out in 4 years when he will be 75 and expects to retire. He says for his tiny practice, electronic medical records just don't make sense. It would cost too much to make the switch and maintain a new system.
No possible business model would endorse that kind of implementation in a practice that's situated like mine. It's crazy.
Korshan will lose another 1.5% of his Medicare payments next year for failing to enroll in PQRS, a federal program that requires doctors to report quality data. And then there's ICD-10, a new coding system also set to take effect in the fall of 2015. Korshan says small practices can't keep up with all the federal requirements.
This flurry of things one has to comply with and rules that cost money and time to comply with mean that unless you work for a large organization like a hospital that can devote specific staff and time to dealing with these issues, there's no economy of scale. I can't share these expenses with anybody.
Korshan may seem like an outlier, being so close to retirement with such a small practice. But according to the State Medical Association, he's not alone. The association's Mike Hogan says half of the doctors in Alaska are over the age of 50, and very few are employed by large organizations.
Most practices in Alaska are small practices. They're one, two, and three doctor practices. The number of really large practices, and that's relative in Alaska, is you can practically count them on one hand.
Hogan says he hears a lot of complaints from doctors who are feeling overwhelmed by the federal requirements for practicing medicine. And he worries the burden is forcing many, especially older doctors, to consider retiring early.
There won't be some flashing neon sign that we ever see that says X number of doctors have left. It's a very quiet process, and that, for me, that's the scary part, because you take a look at the Medical Association membership a year or two from now, or just the number of practicing doctors, and it may be smaller. And access to care in this state is a real issue.
But Rebecca Madison thinks a lot of doctors would decide to stay in practice if they had help with the transition to electronic health records. That's Madison's job as executive director of Alaska eHealth Network. She works to make it as easy as possible for providers to make the switch to EHRs, and she encounters a lot of resistance.
We hear everything from, it'll never work for them, it's too costly for them, especially for some of the older providers in the state who are coming towards the end of their time in their practice, and that's a huge investment.
Madison tries to sell doctors on the benefits. Electronic records can make their offices more efficient and give them better data on the care they're providing, and it will make it easier when it comes time to sell their practices. Madison also sees the issue from the patient's perspective.
My whole goal, and the reason I got into this in 2006 when I started this process, is to give the data to the patient. They deserve to have it. It's their data. They should be able to access it.
But Madison says she understands electronic records won't work for every doctor, and she thinks that's okay. Remember Oliver Korshin and his letter asking the federal government for an exemption from the electronic records requirement due to old age? He got a response through Senator Murkowski in May. It was denied. Korshin says he will continue practicing regardless, the old-fashioned way. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Petersburg kids get a lesson in bluegrass.
You know, this camp in particular has some really unique kids involved. They pick up things really fast.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
Election workers are reporting a steady turnout for today's primary. Nearly 10,000 voters cast their ballots early compared to 5,000 voters in the 2010 primary. Drawing people to the polls are two major races, a referendum that would repeal a tax break on oil production and a three-way contest for the Republican Party's U.S. Senate nomination. Polls are open until 8 p.m. and returns will be coming in shortly after. Alaska state troopers have arrested a 16-year-old male and charged him with arson for setting a house in Delta Junction on fire last weekend and for the May 15th fire that destroyed the Clearwater Lodge. KUAC's Jim Ellis reports.
Troopers investigating the May 15th fire that destroyed the Clearwater Lodge got a big break in the case Monday when they were questioning a juvenile about another fire on Sunday that heavily damaged a Delta area home. Troopers say they found evidence at the scene that showed the house had been broken into and that items had been stolen before it was set on fire. According to a trooper report issued this morning, investigators were able to identify the suspect and the vehicle he allegedly was using. The report says the 16-year-old admitted to the theft and arson. During the investigation, troopers also learned the juvenile was responsible for the Clearwater Lodge fire. The report is unclear how, but the implication is that he admitted to that crime as well. The juvenile's identity hasn't been released. Troopers don't identify juveniles involved in criminal cases. Monday's arrest was good news to Kevin Ewing, who, along with his wife Patsy, owned the lodge. Ewing says he hopes that others, who he suspects also were involved, will also be rounded up.
We're very happy that this group are off the street and not doing this kind of stuff anymore.
Ewing estimates the arsonists that destroyed his lodge will cost him about $1 million. He says his insurance policy didn't cover the $500,000 appraised value of the structure, and the Ewings plan to build a new lodge on the side of the old one on the banks of the Clearwater River east of Delta. The juvenile charged with arson was taken to Fairbanks Youth Facility Monday night on multiple charges of arson, theft, and other offenses in connection with the two fires. Investigators can't say yet whether others were involved. An investigation in both cases continues. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
A large soil cleanup project at a former Cold War mountaintop radio site near Petersburg is underway this summer. A contractor for the U.S. Air Force is removing soil contaminated by fuel and building debris left at the site after its decommissioning almost three decades ago. KFSK's Joe Vicnicki reports.
The site was a manned Air Force communications station, one of 18 in Alaska built during the 1950s. It was part of an early warning system called White Alice, used to relay radio communications from Clear Air Force Base in Alaska to Colorado Springs 50 years ago. It's on Kuprinoff Island, just south of Omer Slough on Duncan Canal, about 8 miles west of Petersburg. The Duncan Canal Station began relaying radio signals in 1960. It was deactivated in 1976, and the buildings were removed in 1986. The Air Force already had over 100 dumped fuel barrels removed from that area in 2000. Other fuel drums, demolished buildings, trash, and chemical contaminants remain. A contractor working for the Air Force documented PCBs, fuel, chemicals, and heavy metals in the soil and groundwater there. Lori Roy is project manager with the Air Force and says the contaminated soil was more than expected.
We went out and characterized what we thought was pretty good, but of course, we usually see that it's more than anticipated. So we want to ensure that we are cleaning up and getting everything. So we are doing all kinds of excavation and confirmation sampling to make sure that we come away clean and we've done our good job out there.
The main contractor on that job is a company called Bate. They're working on land that's part of the Tongass National Forest and managed by the U.S. Forest Service. The mountaintop site is currently used by AT&T Alascom for a commercial communications facility. It's a relatively remote area and just off the Tonka Road system, and there are a few recreational cabins nearby. Roy says the contractor is not using the Tonka Log Transfer Facility to transport the contaminated soil because of ongoing logging operations in the area. Instead, the contractor is landing a barge closer to the site in Duncan Canal.
We brought all our stuff in through Tonka, and now we're using the alternate area to take the super sacks of soil out. So if people are boating along the shoreline, they'll see tons of super sacks over there in the Duncan Canal area, and we are coming in and out of that side of the island.
Those super sacks are large polypro bags for the contaminated dirt. Roy estimates they'll be filling about 1,000 super sacks with about 785 cubic yards of soil. That will be shipped to a landfill in Arlington, Oregon. The cleanup involves three separate areas, a dump site, a fuel storage area, and a site with debris from the demolition of the buildings. Roy says after the excavation, those sites will be refilled with clean soil.
It will not have the current vegetation on it, but there will be no gaping holes. All the excavations will be filled and tilled, so it'll all be smooth.
Roy says the contractor had not anticipated the daily record rainfall that's hit the area several days this summer, and that's created some problems for excavation. She did not have a dollar amount for the project. The final cost won't be known until that work is complete. However, an environmental decision document on that work estimated the overall price tag would be around $3.5 million once the three sites are all cleaned up, filled with new soil, and tested. The cleanup is about halfway done, and Roy is hoping the project will be finished by the end of September. Soil sampling at the site will continue for a few years after. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized John Deere dealer. The Anchorage location just behind the Ship Creek Salmon Fishing offers a wide range of John Deere compact tractors. CraigTaylorEquipment.com.
After two extensions, the summer king salmon season for trollers in southeast Alaska is over. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game closed the fishery at 11:59 p.m. on Monday, August 18th, 2 days later than planned. Patty Scannis is troll management biologist for the region.
Yeah, we don't usually work on Saturday and Sunday, but this was one of those openings that just required some attention every day, and we set it for 3 days thinking, this is going to be easy, you know, but it turned out to be anything but.
The target for the three-day opener was 36,000 kings, but on day one, it looked like trollers were bringing in about 12 fish a day. An August storm blew in and kept many of the region's 700 trollers off the ocean, so the department extended the opening 24 hours to Sunday night and then another 24 hours until Monday night. In the first summer opener in July, trollers landed almost 200,000 kings. They were paid an average of $3.14 a pound. Although this wraps up the summer season for kings, trollers will still be on the ocean fishing for coho and chum salmon for the next few weeks. And come October, trollers will once again be able to target kings when the winter fishery gets underway. Volunteers with the Kachemak Crane Watch have kept an eye out for sandhill crane adults and colts all summer. The season isn't over yet, but the information collected so far has given the group a decent picture of the crane's progress. KBBI's Quinton Chandler has the story.
Dozens of people dialed into the Crane Watch this year, at first to report the sandhill crane's return to Kachemak Bay in the spring. Nina Faust is co-founder of the Kachemak Crane Watch. She says nearly 100 people have called in with sightings.
We get reports shortly after they've arrived from people who have cranes nesting in their yards, and they let us know that their pair is back or a new pair has arrived and set up a territory.
Like most birds, the cranes follow a regular migratory pattern. They head south for the winter, and then they return north for the summer months to nest and prepare their young for their first migration. But cranes have one thing going for them that most birds don't.
They're incredibly loved by people because of their beautiful dancing. And they are a symbol of fidelity. They're a symbol of loyalty. They're a symbol of longevity.
People love the birds so much, they let them have the run of their property to nest, roost, and take shelter from predators during the summer months. Nina and her husband Edgar Bailey started crane watching between 15 and 20 years ago, and it's become a regular thing for them to host their own crane family each summer.
We started to say, you know, nobody's really done anything with sandhill cranes in the area, and we'd really like to know what is the population here. Is it going down or is it maintaining? Especially because there was a lot of feeding of eagles going on.
Eagles are a major predator of sandhill cranes. Today, Nina and her pup Chipper are keeping a watchful eye on a crane couple and their colt. The birds repeatedly dip their long necks toward the ground and dig for worms a few feet from Nina's front porch, as if we're not even there. Nina calmly backs away each time they move a little closer to give them free access to their next delicacy.
We have to move. The cranes want some gravel. They need gravel in their gizzards to help grind up food. But anyway, nope. Chipper.
This summer, the cranes in the Bay Area seem to have done fairly well. Nina and her partners have an early tally for the season.
So far this year, we had 26 hatched, which is a pretty good number. And of those 26 that were hatched, we have 11 that are confirmed fledged at this point, flying. So that's pretty good. And we had one unhatched egg.
Nina quickly added she meant to say 26 hatched that survived. 9 more colts hatched, but those were taken by predators. 26 surviving hatchlings falls right in the middle of the trend for the past 3 years. In 2011, 2012, and 2013, the number of observed fledged colts reached the 20s each time.
I'd say right in the ballpark of what we would expect for this year, and I'm just waiting to get the final numbers on how many actually fledged.
Once those numbers are in, it will be near time for the adult cranes and their newly fledged colts to take flight for the Sacramento Valley. Nina says the cranes should begin to flock to make their winter trip sometime between the 12th and the 20th of September.
The family will come back to their territory. So next spring, when this family comes back, if that colt makes its migration, and if that colt comes all the way back after migration in the spring, he will come back with his parents to this very property.
No doubt, the cranes will be welcomed back with a new round of calls to Crane Watch. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Kids hit the streets of Petersburg recently to showcase their music skills and raise money for Bluegrass Camp. It's a program that runs throughout the United States, taught by a group of traveling folk musicians. KFSK's Elizabeth Jenkins was there to record the picking.
It's an hour before the kids at Bluegrass Camp will pack up their instruments and perform in an outdoor venue, the sidewalks of downtown Petersburg. They're going busking later.
Busking is kind of like when you get in a group and you practice things and then you're going to go around town like sing for people.
Allie Thomason is in the 8-year-old class brushing up on her guitar playing skills. The instrument is about half the size of her tiny body, but that doesn't stop her from strumming to Oh Susanna. The camp brings in established bluegrass musicians from around the country, like Tyson James Alteri.
I've been living in Nashville. The past 3 summers I've been playing around Alaska, and Tyson James and the Hot Strangs.
Now you guys know, you remember your A chords?
Yes.
Okay, get your A chords ready.
Alteri went to the University of Alaska in Anchorage in the 90s. Since then, he's been working the country music circuit between Los Angeles and Nashville.
But the nature and the beauty of Alaska draws you back.
Teaching gives him the opportunity to travel. He's even taught bluegrass in Hawaii. But he says there's something special about mentoring the kids in Southeast.
You know, this camp in particular has some really unique kids involved. They pick up things really fast. And it seems like music is going to stick to these kids
Well, you can skate in Buffalo.
The class is busking later for the thrill of performing in public, but they're also doing it for something else. 8-year-old Braylon Willis just isn't entirely sure what that is.
I think it's where you go around playing music around town and singing.
And?
And something.
Money for the camp.
Yeah, and you make money for the camp.
From the earnings, they'll purchase more instruments, strings, and picks.
We like to provide the instruments so that people can have a chance to play new instruments that they've never played before.
That's Angela Odine. She plays in a band called Todd Grebe and Cold Country and teaches at the camp. She says for beginning musicians, instruments like the banjo can be hard to come by.
Yeah, a lot of times, especially that instrument, it's going to be their first time playing that instrument, and they're not going to have one at home.
The kids busk on the sidewalk between a local boutique and hardware store. The spot is a prime location for hustling musicians. After performing, Odine counts a stack of dollar bills dropped in a fiddle case.
10, 15, 20, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32 bucks.
In total, the kids earned about $200 busking. It's money they'll put back into next year's bluegrass camp. In Petersburg, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Joe Vicnicki and Elizabeth Jenkins in Petersburg, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Quentin Chandler in Homer. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported in Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Where can you see more than 1,000 entertainers, from Alaska native dancers to dinosaurs? The Alaska State Fair. This year, everyone attending the fair can enjoy music free with fair admission, like Riders in the Sky, Young Dubliners, Redhead Express, Savannah Jack, Home Free, and Kentucky Lineman. Learn more at thealaskastatefair.org. Music, fair food, and good time fun. It's what the Alaska State Fair is all about. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.